From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump signed a revised executive order today to replace his controversial travel ban. The new order temporarily stops travel from six majority Muslim countries, but it no longer includes Iraq. Attorney General Jeff Sessions outlined details of the plan today, along with other members of the Trump cabinet.
Our founders wisely gave the executive branch the authority and the duty to protect the nation. This executive order is a proper exercise of that power.
Now, as we remember, the president's original order led to protests around the country and was put on hold by a federal court. Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
So no Iraq on this list, but six countries remain. They would be Iran, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, Syria, and Libya. The order temporarily bans new visa seekers from those countries from coming here. What else should we know about it?
It says that people who already have legal permanent resident status, what we call green card holders, are exempt. And so are those people who already have a valid visa that's been issued. They can come ahead, although, of course, they'll still be subject to the usual process of immigrating or being a refugee. It says that the countries in question are singled out because they have lacked the proper procedures to provide us with the information we need to vet refugees. So they're trying to make the point that this is not about being Muslim. The official line now is that Iraq has gained this capacity since way back in January, and so that is the reason they have been dropped from the list. There are a couple of things that this executive order does not say that the first one did. For example, it does not have a separate ban on Syrian refugees the way the first one did, and it does not include the special treatment of religious minorities. Now, these are all predominantly Muslim countries, so when they talk about religious minorities, they're talking about Christians, and that special treatment for that group is gone now.
So what's been the reaction to this so far? Because as we remember, last time there was chaos at airports around the country. There were big protests and lawsuits.
Another big difference is that this time there's a 10-day phase in for this executive order. And lots of preparation and directions are coming from the Department of Homeland Security. When the announcement was made this morning, it was made by the secretaries of three departments, including John Kelly of the Department of Homeland Security, Rex Tillerson of the State Department. And so a lot of instruction is going out to people about how to handle it this time. And that's really making a big difference. So we don't expect to see the same kind of confusion. We've got 10 days to get ramped up at the airport that we saw back in January, at least not yet.
Although I'm going back to a tweet from Donald Trump from the 30th of January, where he was responding to people who said there should have been a waiting period and said, if the ban were announced with a 1 week notice, the bad would rush into our country during that week.
Well, we now have a 10-day notice.
So, right.
So let us hope that the bad are a little more slow-footed than expected.
Ron, another thing I want to ask you about, a big story today from the Supreme Court. It is sending the transgender bathroom case that it was set to hear later this month back to a lower court. Now, this is the case centered on 17-year-old Gavin Grimm. What did the court say, and what does this mean?
It means that the lower court, the Fourth Circuit Court, which had ruled in favor of Gavin Grimm based on what the Obama administration had said about this issue and allowing the choice of which bathroom to use based on the self-identity of these various students and other people, that order has, of course, since been superseded by a one from the new president. So the Supremes are basically saying in a one-sentence order, look at this again in light of this new superseding executive order from the new president and reconsider the policy in the light of that new order before you bring this to us.
So it probably will end up back at the Supreme Court at some point?
It's pretty likely. One side or the other is likely to disagree with whatever the Circuit Court or whatever the Circuit Court of Appeals might rule.
One more thing, Ron. Over the weekend, the president accused President Obama of wiretapping his phones during the campaign. Didn't provide any evidence. But this morning, his counselor, Kellyanne Conway, said this on Fox News when she was asked how the president came to that conclusion.
Let me answer that globally. He's the president of the United States. He has information and intelligence that the rest of us do not. And that's the way it should be for presidents.
But again, the White House hasn't offered any evidence to back up the president's claims. Where does this go from here, Ron?
Well, we're waiting for any indication that the president had any basis for this accusation. Neither he nor the White House has offered any thus far. And people in position to know about it, including that intelligence community that one would assume Kellyanne Conner would be referring to, have all said that it's absolutely false. So we are also waiting to see what the next shoe to drop may be regarding Russian interference in the election campaign and about Russian contacts with various people in Trump world. That is one possible explanation for why Donald Trump has made this accusation at this time.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, we're following some disturbing news about the Marine Corps. The Defense Department is investigating reports that active duty and retired male Marines shared naked photographs of female Marines and other women on a Facebook page called Marines United. Before it was taken down, it had 30,000 followers. Some of the photos were taken without the women's knowledge. Others were lifted from their Instagram accounts. And the posts with the pictures reportedly included obscene comments about rape and assault of some of the women. The allegations were first reported by the website War Horse, which is run by Marine veteran Thomas Brennan, who says he's now getting death threats. Angie Morgan is a retired Marine Corps captain. She's been an advisor on diversity issues to Marine General Joseph Dunford, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She's also co-founder of Lead Star, a leadership development firm. Captain Morgan, Angie, what do you make of this?
It was really disturbing when I heard this news over the weekend because it certainly didn't represent the Marine Corps that I know. I learned everything I know today about leadership from my training and development in the Marine Corps. So when you see behavior of a select few Marines counter to what the culture promotes, it's really disturbing.
Well, you know, and there are people who say, that's wishful thinking. You know, this is exactly what the culture promotes. I mean, for a long time, then all male forces, pin-up girls, have been a part of it. This is kind of the more modern version of that.
I can see where outsiders looking into the culture can be critical. And yes, right, pin-ups, pornography, I would be lying to say that those things never exist in the Corps. But when I think about the culture and its values of honor, courage, and commitment, none of the behavior that I read about over the weekend is reflective of this strong, rich tradition of leadership.
I was thinking of asking you if your picture might have been there, but you have no way of knowing because it's taken down now. Does that
Yes.
also maybe give you a little bit of a, you know, a feeling of being more vulnerable than maybe you thought you were? You don't even know. And some of these comments were just brutal about the women.
Yeah, they were derogatory. They are horrific. And those people who made them, I mean, my greatest hope is swift justice brought to them. There is no room in the Corps for those who demonstrated this type of behavior. Now, that's the Marine Corps I believe in.
Right. Does that make you feel a little more, though, you know, I mean, you are a veteran at this point,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, unsure of yourself or the women who are now, as women become more involved in the American military, the women who might be considering that? One of the women whose picture was posted says, even if I could, I'm never reenlisting.
Honestly, in her situation, I don't blame her. Her Marines broke trust with her, and they let her down, and it's sad to hear that. My greatest concern, though, would be for strong women who are thinking about entering the Marine Corps to be unsure of their decision of joining this, what I think, a tremendous fighting force, because I think there needs to be stronger women leaders represented in the Marine Corps to really set a strong example of what women who wear uniform are capable of achieving. I hope that women, again, who are thinking about this as a career option, really see that they could help positively address some of these negative issues impacting other women.
Yeah. The Marines were the most vocal in their opposition to the idea of women in combat. Do you worry that this could be just a stupid thing, you know, just some stupid online thing, but do you worry that it signals something else, part of that resistance?
I've been, you know, certainly aware that there has been a resistance with women's growing roles in the Marine Corps, but I think overall when you hear the commandant of the Marine Corps, you know, when the decision was made saying the Marines will do the right thing, he was very serious. I think time will tell ultimately how women perform in these expanded roles, and I have great confidence within the strong women leaders who, you know, are Marines and their abilities.
Yeah. We understand the person who posted the drive that's being investigated was a former Marine working for a defense contractor. He's since been relieved of his duties. What should happen to the others who participated, who maybe left comments that talk about women should be raped or sexually assaulted?
I have full confidence in the NCIS and the Marine Corps to handle those particular individuals in the best manner forward. I mean, my greater hope, though, for the organization is that the Marine takes this experience, as negative as it is, and uses it as an opportunity to learn and grow from it, not just by addressing those who contributed to the derogatory remarks, you know, against women in the Marine Corps, but then in the future, really think about how we as an organization can make sure that no Marine is subject to this type of abuse.
Well, sure. I mean, the male Marine who wrote about it and discovered it is also being threatened and harassed. That's retired Marine Angie Morgan, co-founder of the leadership development group Lead Star. Angie, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Animal welfare groups have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Agriculture after the USDA abruptly removed a trove of data last month from its website about possible animal welfare violations. The USDA said in a statement that it removed the information to protect personal privacy. One of the groups involved in the lawsuit is Born Free USA, whose CEO Adam Roberts joins us now. Adam, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And the information in question here included enforcement records related to the Animal Welfare Act and the Horse Protection Act. What exactly was in this database, and why does your organization need it to be public?
Some of the most important information that was on that online database includes USDA inspection reports. For example, when they inspect roadside zoos or puppy mills under the Animal Welfare Act to try and assess whether there's provision of humane care. It's really important for groups like Born Free USA to have not only access but immediate access to this information, because we get complaints from members of the public on a regular basis about the conditions that they see animals in at their local zoo, which may, as I say, be a roadside zoo or menagerie, and we need to be able to identify quickly whether these are repeat offenders, whether these facilities or actually the individual animal in question has been reported before, so that we can help the complainant report this to the USDA or do so ourselves. So access to these inspection reports is incredibly vital.
So when the USDA says that it took these down for privacy reasons, what do you say?
Well, I say I'm confused, to be quite frank. I mean, these reports have been up for a long time. There's nothing new about them. And so year after year, we're able to have access to these reports online. I'm not quite sure, to be perfectly honest, why all of a sudden there would be some new privacy concern. And even if there were privacy concerns about some individual entities, those could be dealt with either by removing specific information for cause or for a specific purpose, or just redacting some information. But this has never been a problem before, including the 8 years of the previous presidential administration, so I'm just not sure why all of a sudden it's an issue.
Well, some business owners have criticized the USDA database for publicizing their names and addresses along with their inspection reports. A person named Mindy Patterson, who's president of the Cavalry Group, has said that makes it easy for them to be targeted by what she calls animal rights extremists.
Yeah, that's sort of the go-to mentality of people who exploit animals. If you are a licensed entity and the information that would have been available in these inspection reports online are for USDA licensed entities, then it is known to the public already that you are housing certain species of animals and housing them in a certain way. Are you raising dogs to breed them for puppy sales? Are you housing animals like tigers to be shown to the public in a zoo? We already know which entities, which individuals, and which business owners have these animals and are doing this type of business. So then the only question is whether they want to engage in this type of animal exploitation under a shroud of secrecy, where the public is not allowed to know that a polar bear does not have access to water or air conditioning in the south in a zoo or a circus, or a tiger has injuries or a kangaroo has visible wounds. And that's the problem. I think we should be trying to get at this lack of transparency, and that's why the inspection reports have to be put back online immediately.
Would it be okay with you if the USDA made that information available to you when you asked for it, but that it wasn't published online publicly?
This is the mentality and the position of the government currently, is that you can simply request any specific bit of information through the Freedom of Information Act and then receive a reply in writing. Unfortunately, there is an incredible backlog historically in trying to have government agencies, whether it's the USDA, Interior, or any other agency, fulfill written submitted FOIA requests. And so it could take several weeks or months to get the information and at a cumbersome cost of both time and money to the nonprofit or the individual American citizen who is submitting that Freedom of Information Act request. So that seems to me that it's another example of the government trying to hide the nefarious business practices of some of these animal exploiters, rather than saying there's nothing to hide here and we're happy to share the information that both the government has found through their inspections or that the individual entity itself is putting out to the public because they publish those records.
Now, the Senate has not confirmed President Trump's pick to head the USDA. That would be former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue. How do you think he would be on the issues of animal rights that you advocate for?
Well, it's really hard to tell. I mean, I don't anticipate this administration being particularly helpful on issues of animal protection and wildlife conservation, though, of course, as with any administration and any Congress, Born Free and others will push them to be responsible for the issues of animal protection and wildlife conservation, especially when we're talking about dealing with existing laws. You know, this is dealing with the Animal Welfare Act, which was passed, I think, in 1966. So this is not a new law that we're trying to push through. It's simply about enforcing and giving access of information to existing law. But then, you know, we also know that legislators are actually interested in this issue as well, and we're pursuing both legislative and judicial routes to try and get this secrecy undermined and get transparency back on.
That's Adam Roberts, who is the CEO of the animal rights group Born Free USA, which is currently suing the USDA. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And we reached out to the USDA. A spokeswoman said the agency has started putting some information back onto its website and will continue to review records to determine which information is appropriate for reposting.
Well, now let's go into the woods of New Hampshire, a state that is by percentage one of the most forested in the country. A local organization of tree enthusiasts has been finding and documenting New Hampshire's biggest trees since the 1950s. Cordelia Zars from Here Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio headed out with some volunteers to search for a new champion.
It's cold and icy, but that's not enough to stop Tom Howe from hunting for big trees.
So we're going to cut into the left here because I see our whopper green ash.
Hal lumbers down a trail near the southern edge of White Mountain National Forest, trusting his spiky footwear to bring him to this fabled tree.
So this is the big green ash in here.
A massive trunk comes into view, reaching high into the sky and putting its neighbors to shame. It has a thick, cracked bark, like a leather coat worn from the winter.
The one with the kink at the bottom. Yep.
Hal first noticed some big trees on this land back in November when he was surveying it for his job with the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests. Then he brought his whole family back out here to scout for champion trees as part of a statewide competition to find the biggest. The contest is run by the New Hampshire Big Tree Program, which has documented the state's green giants since 1950. Hal thinks he has a winner. County Forester Wendy Scribner and Big Tree volunteer Kamal Knott have come along to make sure.
9.5 feet.
9.5 feet?
Yes.
That's the circumference of the trunk. House Giant measures 110 feet tall, and it has a 36-foot crown spread, which is how far the branches stretch out from side to side. Here's Wendy Scribner.
It's a combination of those three measurements that will, added together, give us a point value, and that's what we use to compare against other trees.
If Hal's green ash has more points than other trees of its species, it will be a new state champ. But first, he has to prove that it really is a green ash. And to do that, Hal's brought along an extra tool.
So the extra tool I have along is a .22 rifle.
Hal squares his rifle on a nearby tree and aims for a low branch on his potential champion, about 40 feet up. The idea is that if Hal can shoot off a live branch, he'll be able to identify the species of tree by something called a leaf scar.
Where that leaf attaches to the twig, it leaves a large scar when it falls off in the fall.
Scribner says the design of that scar tells you whether your tree is a green ash, as Howe hopes, or some other kind of ash. Howe's method of finding leaf scars is unique, but ultimately fails. He's been trying to hit a twig about an inch thick as it wobbles in the wind. Even after 30 minutes of dedicated effort, none of his shots hit their mark. But still, according to Mary Thibault Davis, it's the process that counts.
When people get out there looking at big trees, they start to feel that they're part of something much bigger.
Davis works for UNH Cooperative Extension, which runs the Big Tree Program. She says part of the program's mission is to raise awareness about trees and nature.
When you start to look at trees, you see all the connections that they have to everything else, wildlife, soils, water, and us. You know, we're all part of the same ecosystem.
The New Hampshire Big Tree Program is part of a national initiative run by American Forests. Anyone can nominate a tree, and once a year, the state submits their biggest trees to the national program to see if they've got any countrywide victors. Out of 700 trees on the national register, New Hampshire currently holds the title for 11. The tallest overall is a 150-foot eastern white pine. The state of California holds the official title for the country, with a coast redwood named Hyperion. The giant measures 379.3 feet tall.
114 inches.
Back in the snowy Sandwich Forest, Big Tree volunteers finish their final measurements. Scribner and Knott will have to return in the spring to determine if Howe's tree is, in fact, a green ash. And if it is, it will be a new state champion. For Here and Now, I'm Cordelia Zars.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. And you may be relieved this tax season to hear that the IRS is doing fewer audits. In fact, in 2016, the number of IRS audits dropped for the sixth straight year, according to the Associated Press. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and her new podcast, Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So the number of people the IRS audited dropped 16% last year compared to the year before that. Corporate audits also down. What's going on?
You know, the IRS says this is all about budget cuts. Since 2010, the agency's budget has shrunk by $1 billion, from $12.2 to $11.2 billion. And, you know, the IRS now has about 17,000 fewer employees, and that includes nearly 7,000 enforcement agents. So that means with fewer resources, the agency just can't get to as many audits.
So why has the IRS been facing such cutbacks?
You know, I think it's complicated. It started really with a general pullback of government spending. Remember the sequester and all the budgeting that was being done then. But, you know, this did amp up a little bit around the political world when Republicans were targeting the IRS after it was revealed that the agency really was singling out conservative political action groups for extra scrutiny. You know, this emerged mostly in the press in 2012. The IRS commissioner was actually censured last summer. So, you know, this has been a bit political as well.
And the Treasury Secretary, the new Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, has said he'd like to increase IRS staffing levels.
Yeah, that was a little bit interesting because Mnuchin certainly surprised some Republicans when his confirmation hearing was going on. He said he wanted to see a priority to be rebuilding the IRS staff. Meanwhile, we get the White House budget proposing a more than 14% cut to the IRS for the fiscal year that begins in October. So those two are obviously at odds.
So if there are fewer audits, Jill, does that mean people don't have to be as careful when they do their taxes or what?
No, we never say that. I mean, first of all, I know that overall audits for sure are lower. But of course, the higher your income, the more likely you are to be audited. The IRS audited 1.5 3.7% of returns that reported more than $200,000 in income, 5.8% of returns if you're lucky enough to make more than $1 million. But, you know, the odds are that you're not going to get audited. The scary thing is that if you do get audited, it's not a pleasant experience.
And what are the red flags that get the IRS's attention, even with reduced staffing?
You know what the biggest flag is? Not reporting your income. Remember, the IRS receives copies of all the tax documents that you receive. So, by the way, if you have gotten any incorrect forms, hurry up, talk to the issuer, make sure corrections are made. And by the way, if you earned money and you did not receive a tax form, maybe you're in the gig economy, still you should report it. And also, the IRS computers, they've got all of your historic data. So when there's a big change, it can trigger a red flag, maybe a change in income, or that you're claiming big-time deductions that are disproportionately large compared with your income. Look, this doesn't mean you shouldn't try to claim these things. It just means you better have all your documentation before you start claiming them.
So we can't get a financial expert like Jill Schlesinger to say, don't be careful with your taxes. I realized the other day, the other thing that people like you will never say is it's a good time to sell your stocks.
Let me just say this. With markets at highs, I'll tell you what, it is a good time. It's a good time to rebalance your portfolio.
Always a good time to rebalance. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Kate Hamer's stunning debut novel, The Girl in the Red Coat, came out in paperback recently. It's a powerful read, but be prepared. It takes on every parent's worst nightmare. A mother and daughter, Beth and Carmel, go to a crowded outdoor storytelling fair. Beth knows to hold on to 8-year-old Carmel, who tends to wander, but the air is thick with fog, and Carmel just disappears into it. What follows is a stomach-churning, do-not-read-right-before-bedtime-but-gorgeously-written look at the ties that bind mother and child and the wrenching tear when they are broken. We see Carmel's disappearance from both points of view, mom and daughter, as Carmel is snatched by a religious fanatic who thinks the child has powers. Maybe she does. The Girl in the Red Coat was an Amazon Best Book of the Year last year and got rave reviews from The Guardian and Michiko Kakutani in The New York Times. We spoke with Kate Hamer shortly after publication. How could you? My heart is racing even now, just anticipating talking to you about, you know, a child abduction.
I know. It is obviously such a difficult subject, and it's certainly one I don't think I could have tackled when my children were young. Mm. I think to a certain extent with writing, you do work out your fears and put them on the page so they're in a nice containable form with, you know, two hard covers keeping them safe inside. And I think that's certainly the case with this. I mean, it's every parent's fear.
And you spare no emotion in this. Where did it come from? You say maybe just to talk out what every parent fears, but was there a particular story that you heard that you started to wonder about?
No, not really. It's it kind of came to me in the form, I would say, of an image, which was of a little girl in a red coat and standing in a kind of woods or a forest. And in it, I thought she looked lost in this image. So really, the mission of the book was to find out what had happened and why. It was quite a persistent image I carried around with me for a couple of weeks.
Well, it could be, as Michiko Kakutani points out, maybe it's Little Red Riding Hood, you know, floating up from your childhood. We were told fairy tales about, you know, almost cautionary tales about little girls and children who get lost.
I think definitely. But it's strange how the process works. It was only really after I finished the first draft that I thought that might be the case. Mm. But certainly I was brought up with fairy tales. And my mum was a secondhand book fiend. And so I had old, almost Victorian versions, and they didn't spare the child, I tell you. Yeah. These, they were, probably quite close to the traditional tales, actually.
Yeah. We'll start with talking about how you plumb what happens to Beth. And by plumb, it's sort of, you literally have to get into her stomach, you know, which is, you know, convulsing. I mean, what was it like to try to describe what would happen to a mother when, just start with that day, when you turn around and that child's not there?
I think you picked up on something there. I did really, I focused on physical sensations because I imagined grief as being a very, very physical thing. So that's certainly reflected in the way she deals with everything. You know, she feels everything very viscerally.
Well, anyone who's had a child wander off, it's like you go from zero to 150, you know, and you look like a crazy person to everybody around you, you know,
yeah.
You know, help me. And then there comes a point where Beth is sort of having to live with this idea that her child is gone. It's gone on for 100 days, 150 days. And she's in that world of, wow, if I even have any normalcy, will that be abandoning her? She goes into a room, looks at her things. Would you just read that paragraph?
I left her room, all the breath she took in there, her thoughts that still bumped around the ceiling. She seemed to flit around me. I wondered for a split second, was she ever real? Had I dreamt up her whole life? I went into the bathroom and pulled the cord so the harsh bulbs above the mirror showed me in a blaze. I pulled up my T-shirt. There she was, in the tracks spreading across my belly, marks made as if by small skeleton hands, fine, silvery.
I'm thinking, in a way, I've been asking, you know, how could you live with this story? But in a way, maybe you're a little luckier than the reader, because did you know where the story was going? Did you already know?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. And I did know more or less from the beginning. I wrote the first chapter in one go, but I wrote the ending pretty soon after that. Yeah, the last two paragraphs. I think that's sort of emerging as the way that I work.
So you did know what those last two paragraphs were like. We don't, the readers, and we're page turning. So come to writing Carmel. Who, by the way, has been snatched by a man who lies to her, which is what child predators do, tells her that her mother's dead, that her father doesn't want her. At one point, she's standing by a tree and she looks to the way the branches are formed. Could you read that?
The crying cup, I say, because sometimes it makes me feel better to give names to things. I lean over and let the tears fall down there. They splash onto the hot, dry wood and it makes the burn smell stronger. The little puddle there is like Tara's puddle on her desk. And I try not to let them, but thoughts of Mum come rushing into my head, and I can't make them stop. Only now she's not saying courage, Carmel, courage, or anything like that. She can't say anything because she's dead.
So now, are you having your heart broken imagining what a child feels like when they're separated from their parent?
Yeah, I read an interesting thing recently. It was something like all books about missing people are crime novels, but they're also love stories too. And I think that's really appropriate for this book. It really, at the heart of it, it's about mothers and daughters. That's the real beating heart of the novel, I would say.
Did you do any research? There have been children who've been abducted, who've been returned, who tell what they were thinking. Did you read anything, try to put some reality?
Do you know, I made a very concrete decision right at the beginning that I didn't want to do any research into real-life cases. I didn't want to sort of paste details of stories from the news onto this, you know, a novel. And secondly, it was a kind of respect, I think, for families that have actually gone through this. I didn't want to appropriate the details of their families and put it onto my characters. So I made a really conscious decision not to go down that road.
Did you ever worry? You know, there seems to be the genre of the missing girl, gone girl, the good girl, the girl on the train, don't look now, the couple grieving their dead daughter. And there's also, you know, whole television shows that are devoted to girls who have been murdered or are missing. It gives this sense that we are living in a terrible Grimm's fairy tale and all young girls are in danger of being snatched. Did you ever worry about adding to that? Because actually, you know, most children do not.
Yeah, sure.
Snatched.
I think that's a really valid point, actually. And it was in my mind as I was writing. And it's a difficult one. It's, you know, how much do you sort of, in terms of fiction, when you're writing fiction, do you not want to write about something because it's fiction? I'm not sure where the answers lie on that one, actually. I think, as long as you, when you're writing, if you stay in your own personal boundaries and you don't do anything that makes you feel really uncomfortable, I kind of feel okay if I stay within those limits. As a writer, what the only thing you really have is your instincts and your imagination. Those are the two things. So they sort of interplay with each other.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, you give Carmel a certain strength. I mean, it's very hard to read as she's a little girl, and as she believes people she shouldn't, and as she wanders past people that could possibly help her but doesn't realize it, and you just, it just breaks your heart. But you also give her, and we don't want to give too much away, you also give her some power.
Yeah, she's, I don't know if you have the phrase, an old head on young shoulders, or an old soul.
Old soul,
An old soul, yeah. She's very much an old soul in this world.
That's Kate Hamer talking about one of her characters, Carmel, a little girl who is abducted early on in her debut novel, The Girl in the Red Coat. But readers, stay with it. Kate, thank you.
Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.
We spoke with Kate Hamer last March. Her book, The Girl in the Red Coat, is out in paperback. You can read an excerpt which presents both mother and daughter perspectives at hereandnow.org.
The American suburb is dying. That's the claim of a new series this week from Business Insider, which looks at a number of suburban mainstays that are all changing dramatically. Things like McMansions, golf courses, and shopping malls. Ashley Lutz is deputy editor at Business Insider. She's leading the series, and she joins us from New York. Ashley, welcome.
Thanks so much.
So what is the evidence that suburbs are dying? Are there stats to back that up?
So the suburbs as we know them are dying. People still live in suburbs, and people who live in suburbs still outnumber people in cities about 7-1. But if you look at construction data and housing data, you're going to see some major changes. So construction of single-family homes has fallen by about 1/3 between 2005 and 2015. Hmm. And construction of apartments and condos is at the highest level in 40 years.
And that tells you that people are moving into apartments and condos in cities, or is that also in the suburbs?
We're seeing the landscape of the suburbs change dramatically. So a lot of people who would have normally lived in single-family homes are instead choosing to move into apartments and condos, and that's in the suburbs. And you're also seeing a really big influx of people moving into the cities. So those are the two factors that are kind of changing the landscape of how Americans live.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in this piece is McMansions, that people are not as attracted to McMansions anymore.
McMansions are plummeting in value. Data from the real estate site Trulia shows that what people pay for McMansions has declined in 85 of 100 of the country's biggest cities. Mm. So people just aren't as interested in living in these kind of homes anymore.
Now, another key thing about the suburbs is there's usually a mall, and it's usually got a big anchor store in it. And what we're already hearing about is Macy's having some trouble, JCPenney, some of these anchor stores that would be in malls. How does that impact the suburbs?
So malls used to be a big draw of the suburbs. So people would pay a premium to live near the mall, to live near what was essentially at the time the city center. And now we're seeing anchor stores like Macy's, Sears, and JCPenney close hundreds of stores. That's putting the future of so many malls in jeopardy. It's estimated that nearly a quarter of the malls in the U.S. are in danger of shutting down right now. And so that spells a lot of trouble for these suburban communities because malls are a big employer.
You also get into the casual dining establishments that are dotted throughout the suburbs. And I'm thinking of places like Chili's and Applebee's and all these restaurants that have been there for a long time. But they're not doing so well right now, you write.
Yeah. Casual dining chains like Ruby Tuesday, Fridays, Applebee's are closing hundreds of locations as well. A lot of people are choosing to make their own food at home, or they want to seek out more mom and pop type establishments, or they just want to go get fast food. But people just aren't willing to pay a premium for the traditional suburban experience anymore.
So one more aspect that you get into in this series is golf courses. What's happening there?
Hundreds of golf courses across the country are shutting down. Millennials just aren't as interested in playing golf. People aren't interested in paying to play golf. They would rather do other things with their time. They're more entertained by technology these days.
So what does all this mean for the country if suburbs are dying, as you say?
we're seeing a really dynamic change in suburbs and in the way they live. So the line is completely blurring between the cities and the suburbs. And you're seeing suburbs start to look a lot more like cities, where people are kind of valuing walkability, they're valuing sustainability, and they're valuing living within their means more than ever before. And so the suburbs that I grew up in and that a lot of my friends grew up in are disappearing. We're seeing totally different communities springing up across the country.
And what about the people who don't buy into this argument? Economist Jed Kolko told the Washington Post that the U.S. continues to suburbanize, and recent census figures show that the population of suburbs is actually growing faster than that of many U.S. cities.
So this is the suburbs as we know them. And so, yes, people are still moving to suburbs. People are still moving to a community that is technically defined as a suburb. But what we're seeing is the landscape of these suburbs changing dramatically from what it was 20 years ago, from what it was in the 90s. The financial crisis really changed people's attitudes, and urban planners across America are working to remake the suburbs to fit modern needs.
That suburbs are going to be more like cities.
Yeah, the line is completely blurring between suburbs and the cities. You know, a lot of people still thought that the oldest part of the city is the urban area. And what you're seeing is suburbs are turning more into looking like that urban area. So urban planners, such as in the city of New Rochelle in New York, are completely redesigning the landscape so that people can ride their bikes to different places. This is just a total shift in values.
What suburb did you grow up in?
I grew up in Fairfield, Ohio. It's about 20 minutes outside of Cincinnati. And, you know, I saw in my hometown that the mall shut down. You know, it used to be full of stores. Now there are only a couple of stores left. And I'm seeing my parents' generation moving into the cities and choosing to live in a smaller condo instead of the huge 4 or 5 bedroom house that they used to live in.
And you live in a city now, of course.
I live in New York, yeah.
Right. Okay. That's Ashley Lutz, deputy editor at Business Insider. We'll link you to their series, Death of Suburbia, at hereandnow.org. Ashley, thanks.
Thank you so much.
And while you're at hereandnow.org, let us know what you think. Are the suburbs dying? Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.